This is Doug Kay, the host and producer of IT Conversations. And today I'm excited to bring you this presentation from PopTech, held in Camden, Maine, October 21st through 23rd, 2004.
We're now moving on to a connected conversation about new solutions. And our first speaker is a fellow at Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He focuses on the impact of technology on the developing world. In 2000, he founded Geek Corps. I guess you'd say Geek Corps. He will address the issue of whether it's Geek Corps or Corpse. And the purpose of Geek Corps was to pair skilled volunteers from high-tech companies with businesses in emerging nations. Before Geek Corps, he co-founded Tripod, a pioneer in the web community space. In 2002, he received the Technology in Service of Humanity Award from MIT's Technology Review. Please welcome Ethan Zuckerman.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks to all the organizers. I'd like to start by offering the ancestral greetings of my people, which are as follows. Go Sox! Moving on immediately, I want to move back in time. There are no ice cores harmed in the making of this presentation, but we're going to head back in time to the late 1990s, where a full 70% of PowerPoint slide decks had a slide like this in them. It's a logarithmic curve going from dead zero all the way straight up to infinity. And this particular curve represents the number of hosts added to the internet. But you could substitute almost anything having to do with the internet, and this growth looks more or less like this from January of 1994 until the present. In fact, from 1994 until about January 2002, the number of users on the internet doubled every 12 months. And if you were a little bit good at math, you might find yourself looking at this graph and saying, hey, 6.3 billion people online, no problem. It's going to happen in a couple more years. As people started looking at this slightly more carefully and realizing that there was, in fact, no mathematical law that dictated that the internet had to double every year, people realized that there were some really interesting disparities between who was getting online and growing this curve and who wasn't. Specifically, if you were white, wealthy, and lived in an urban neighborhood, you had a much better chance of getting online if you were a poor person of color living in a rural area. Now, this ended up becoming referred to as the digital divide. Now, a lot of people look at the digital divide and say, is this really a problem? And in fact, if you think about access to the internet as a luxury item, it isn't, in fact, a big problem. In fact, there's a BMW divide between these communities as well, which is, in fact, one of the things that people often quip when this comes up. But when you start realizing how critical internet access is to success in the U.S. economy, it actually starts looking like a very important socio-political divide. And in fact, the U.S. government sprang into action. You had a wonderful set of reports called Falling Through the Net. And under the Clinton administration, you actually had a lot of effort to get computers into schools and libraries and such. Evidently, the digital divide is now solved, because if you go to digitaldivide.gov, it got taken down about 2 years ago, which sort of goes to show that we perhaps think that we've made it through this divide in the U.S. so far. The bad news is that we sure as heck have not made it through this divide in an international sense. And so in 2000, while you had more than 50% of Americans having regular home or work access to the internet, when you start getting into some trickier parts of the world, those numbers quickly fall much lower than 1%. And in fact, we're having a very hard time getting those numbers to grow. So if you're really interested in this notion of whether the World Wide Web is in fact worldwide, the obvious answer at the moment is it's not. And in fact, we have a long way to go. And growing that curve up to 6 billion is going to be remarkably tricky. So I found myself getting interested in this idea where I spent my time during the dot-com era, which is a town not unlike Camden, Maine. We also have more cows than people, and we also have lots of people roaming the streets looking at pretty trees. Williamstown, Massachusetts, where I was involved, as Bob said, with a company called Tripod. Tripod, despite being based in a town of 8,000 people, ended up being a remarkably globally focused business. In fact, we ended up looking at our user base in 1997 and realizing that next to users in the US and the UK, most of our users came from Malaysia. Now, we couldn't really figure this out, so we simply went ahead and embraced it. We sponsored the 1996 Malaysian Olympic team. They took the silver in pairs badminton, the men's. We were very happy with that. What we figured out once we finally found someone who could actually read Malay was that we were hosting thousands of Malaysian human rights activists. We were essentially hosting the entire community that was working to support Anwar Ibrahim against the repressive government. And so I had this sudden realization, which was that the internet really could be truly global. It might be a very disconnected conversation, but for me it raised this issue of how do you connect this conversation even further? If the people in Williamstown and the people in Malaysia have something to say to one another, do the people in Malaysia and the people in Ghana have something to say to one another? How far can you take this idea out? So I sat down and I put together a business plan. I'm going to share it with you. It's a detailed, very well thought out, I would have to say, business plan. It worked extremely well for us. Here it is in total. To really... The truth is the actual business plan doesn't look much different from this. To really benefit from the internet, you gotta have geeks. It's not enough just to have access to the internet. If you actually want to do something with the internet, if you want to build things, if you want to create things, you have to have people who understand how the net works, how servers work, how to program. So you gotta get geeks if you really want to do cool stuff with the net. There are a few geeks in Africa. There are not a lot. I lived in Ghana, West Africa, in 1994. And at that point, to get online, you actually had to dial America Online in the UK. My wife and I went back to Accra in 99, and we found a large number of cyber cafes. Most of them didn't work. Most of them were just getting started. But there was a small population of geeks trying to get off the ground. And I found that pretty exciting. Geeks beget geeks. I don't really mean this in the literal sense, although it does happen every now and then. A few of my friends are starting to have children. I'm quite sure they'll be geeks. But geeks beget geeks in the sense that geekery is one of the last great apprenticeship industries. If you want to learn how to be a geek, it's very, very difficult to do it by going to school. You generally learn it from working with someone else who knows what they're doing, really knows how to code, and can get you initiated into this wonderful world. So our theory was if we take geeks who are burnt out from the dot-com era, psyched to do something adventurous, give them plane tickets, ship them off to the developing world, great things will happen. And this is, in fact, what we proceeded to do. And over the course of about 5 years, we sent about 200 high-tech professionals to 12 different countries for anywhere from 4 to 6 month stints working with small businesses all over the world. So here's the thing. If this were my sort of standard speech to you guys, I would now go on to tell you 3 or 4 great stories of the good that we've done in the world. I would then try to identify the people in the crowd who spoke C++. I would get you on an airplane to Mongolia, and I'd get the rest of you to pay for it. The awkwardness of this is that I got fired in April. And in fact, the rest of my staff left shortly after that. So soon you're going to hear about social entrepreneurship from David, and I'm here as a somewhat successful and somewhat failed social entrepreneur. So GeekCore is no more. I'm happy to tell you more about it if you buy me a beer and if you are, brave enough to let me talk your ear off. But for now, what I want to talk about instead is the larger question of the field that GeekCore ended up in, which is ICT for development. It's this horrible acronym at the top. ICT for Development sort of reveals what happened when people went about addressing the international digital divide, which is to say that the people who went after it first were development professionals. They were the sort of people who work on famine, hunger relief, so on and so forth. They work in desperately parts of the globe, and they work on the following priorities, which is an extremely difficult set of priorities to work your way through. It's going to be utterly amazing if we manage to achieve most of these Millennium Development Goals by 2015, because they are very difficult and very universal. They involve getting these services to everybody in the 191 nations that the UN is looking at. One of the problems is that it costs an awful lot of money. $100 billion a year is a conservative estimate at best. We give about $56 billion a year collectively, all developed nations. The U.S. turns out to be the best donor in dollar terms, the worst donor in percentage terms. And so there's an estimate that rich nations as a whole would have to move from giving about 0.3% of GDP up to about 0.7% of GDP. And the truth is we're not. And in fact, if you can look at what's happening in the U.S., we start talking Marshall Plan for Iraq, the truth is we're at about a tenth of our giving level that we were during the Marshall Plan. And any giving that we're giving in Iraq or that we're giving in Afghanistan is not getting given in Africa, for instance. So this is a really big problem. What this means is that for anybody who works in my field, you end up, trying to make trade-offs all the time. Plantains versus PCs is a great way to think about this trade-off. In 2000, in the Dominican Republic, Leonel Fernandez, who was this amazing reformist president, his party got run out of power by a crooked son of a bitch named Hipólito, who ran on the slogan, "Plantains, not PCs." And essentially what he was saying was, the Dominican Republic is so poor, we can't afford to invest in technology. We can't afford to move forward and invest in our future. We need to deal with the basic needs of the people. My contention on this is that everybody has to make the decision, plantains and PCs. You've got to find a way to do both at the same time, no matter how hard it ends up being. You have to deal with the immediate problems as well as the long-term prospects for growth. So let's talk a little about, given the scenario that we're dealing with, these huge problems, the need to reach populations all over the world, the need to prioritize IT needs and standard development needs. This tends to lead us towards IT projects that are very, very small, because they have to be cheap, that tend to be extremely rural, because we're trying to demonstrate that we can affect everybody in the world, and that tend to be tied into other development efforts. There's a real emphasis in ICT for development against development for development's sake. So the typical experiment is to set up a cyber cafe in the middle of a poor village and try to figure out, will the users of the cyber cafe find a way to better their lives in development terms based on having the magic of the internet? It turns out there's a couple of problems with this. Problem number one is electricity. Now, this is a NASA image. This is a patchwork of images of the Earth at night. And you can see pretty quickly that in the parts that we consider to be the developing world, there's not a whole lot of lights at night. In other words, there's not a whole lot of electricity. Electricity turns out to be a massive part of the digital divide. It's possible to get online in areas where you don't have regular electric power, but it gets very, very expensive. Solar and diesel are both significantly more expensive than grid power at this point, and so it ends up being a huge obstacle to having this stuff work cost effectively. Another huge obstacle ends up being telephony. In Ghana, which is sort of one of the better of the low development nations, we have what we call teledensity. We have 1.2 phones per 100 people. Now, you need phone lines, to a certain extent, if you're going to run computers. It's certainly what the advent of the internet in the US and Europe was built on top of. The fact that you can't rely on this phone infrastructure in rural parts of developing nations ends up being enormously important. There are big linguistic problems. The vast, vast majority of content on the web is in English. And the vast majority of the world's population doesn't speak English. In fact, when you get into functional literacy rather than pure literacy statistics, when you actually get to people who are comfortable reading large amounts of text, there's large chunks of the world where illiteracy is 50% or higher. This all adds up to what ends up being called the relevancy divide. Why would you want to pay money to access the internet? What are you, as a subsistence farmer in rural Ghana, going to get out of using the internet? And so 5 years into this quest for ICT for development, there's been an incredible track record of failure. There have been lots and lots of people setting up cyber cafes in rural areas, letting it be open to people to use things, and for the most part, people have had a very hard time making these projects sustainable and sort of making money off of them. 5 years into this, we look like the international digital divide is in fact a very, very difficult problem to bridge. So this difficult problem is one that I've largely chosen to ignore because it looks really, really hard. So GeekCore took a very different philosophy and a very different tack on this problem. Rather than looking in the very rural areas, we looked in urban areas. Rather than looking at the desperately poor, we tended to look at the middle class. We tended to look at people who were already IT entrepreneurs, people who were already interested in getting involved with technology, going out, building businesses. And this was part of a philosophy that we ended up referring to as digital independence. Our goal was to get a country like Ghana to the point where it could take on its technology needs within the country, rather than reaching outside of the country. This was our main goal with this. And so this is a great example of what digital independence starts looking like. This is the Accra City Linux Users Group. These are probably the best programmers and system administrators in the city of Accra. They're jointly working on a project called Twinix, which is a TWI and English language Unix site. They're working together to share expertise, help their businesses get off the ground. In 3 or 4 years, these guys will probably be a really high-functioning geek ecosystem. And in fact, you've already got people throughout the region coming to Ghana to learn from them. So once you start looking at this group of people, once you start looking at the digital independence problem, there's actually really good news about the digital divide in the developing nations, which is to say there are amazing businesses. This is a business called Busy Internet. This is a 200-seat cyber cafe in downtown Accra. And when you look at it, you can see it's a pretty high-end cyber cafe. Those are flat panel monitors. It's got a sort of beautiful European wood interior. It's profitable, incidentally. It made money from about 3 months into the project. And it's profitable being filled with middle-class Africans. This place is filled 24/7, 365. What you cannot see in this photo is the 50 people sitting in chairs waiting for terminals. People are interested in paying money, meaningful money, 80 cents an hour, to get online, send email, read news, do research. Mark Davies, who put together this project with a bunch of Ghanaian investors, figured out something really important, which is that you can tell whether you've got a functioning middle class in a country by whether you're selling beer. If people have money to buy beer, they have disposable income. And it turns out that if you price cyber cafe connectivity at the price of 1 hour of connectivity equals a beer, you can often run a really good business. One of the ways we know that Busy and other organizations are doing well is that beer sales in Ghana are down about 5% over the last 3 to 4 years because of both cyber cafes and cell phone use. Here's another extraordinary business. This guy in front of the satellite dish is Francis Quarte. And he's a telecom engineer. He's Ghanaian. He spent 10 years in the US working with AT&T. He came back to Ghana. He built the third largest ISP in the country. What's amazing about this ISP is it's a WISP. It's a wireless ISP, which is something that you're only starting to see in the US now as people start looking at very challenging terrain. But it had to be wireless in Ghana because the telephone system sucks. So Francis went around and actually started designing his own wireless hardware. So he's got 300 boxes that he's made in his shop in Ghana that get people on wirelessly, not using the phone system, connecting them from kilometers around Accra. So my contention from this is that there's a ton of money, actually, to be made in the developing world. In fact, in many ways, there may be more money over the next decade than there is to be made in the mainstream technology world. As you start having large populations come online in India, China, some of these other places, there's enormous growth in these markets. My second contention would be to say that the companies that are going to do this may well not be American multinationals. They may well be very smart, creative firms that end up outcompeting us. And the reason I think they're going to outcompete us, as I'm about to say in a moment, is that for the most part, when it comes to the developing world, we're idiots. So I'll get there in half a moment. This is one of my favorite new products that I'm seeing coming out of the developing world. This is coming from a design firm in Dubai. This is the world's first Islamic cell phone. It knows where Mecca is. It sounds the call to prayer. After it sounds the call to prayer, it switches into vibrate mode so you don't disturb anyone in the mosque. It has the full text of the Quran on board. It ended up being a partnership between Dubai and South Korea to actually manufacture. But identifying the market, which incidentally they think is 300 million units over the next 3 years for the world's 1.2 billion Muslims, that's pure developing world ingenuity. And that's where I think a lot of technology development is going. Now, I mentioned that I thought we were idiots, and let me try to explain why it's mostly not our fault. If we take a look at Japan and Nigeria, we've got roughly the same size countries. We've got radically differently sized economies, but we do have two tremendously newsworthy places. Nigeria should be in the news all the time. You've got ethnic conflict, you've got oil, you've got all sorts of strife, tremendous security importance for us, but it's not in the news. In fact, if you look at CNN over the last 5 years, you've got roughly 12,500 stories on Japan. You've got under 1,000 stories in Nigeria. Basically, CNN isn't watching Nigeria in a meaningful way. This is what I've been doing lately. I've been mapping what the media is watching. So every morning, and you can go to my websites and see this, I'll tell you what the New York Times is looking at. And if it's in red, the New York Times is looking at it. If it's in blue, they're looking at it very little. So the darker the red is, the more media intensity, the darker the blue, the less media intensity. A couple of really quick conclusions you can draw from this. Not a lot of attention in Africa. Not a lot in Central Asia. Not a lot in Eastern Europe. Not a lot in most of South America, except for the big booming economies. Okay? Now, an interesting thing about this map is that Iceland doesn't get much attention, neither does the Democratic Republic of Congo. Here's the thing. Iceland is 250,000 people. Democratic Republic of Congo is 52 million. So the first thing you might do when you find these results is try to adjust them for population. So essentially, who gets overcolored or undercolored based on the population? So here's an adjusted map. When you adjust this map for population, suddenly Iceland is tremendously overcovered. Much, much more attention than you would expect those 250,000 people to get, who incidentally are very rich. The people in the Congo, suddenly very, very, very undercovered. What you can actually learn from this pretty quickly is that population is a lousy way to predict where the media is going to look. The media actually doesn't spend a lot of time looking at particularly populous nations, particularly populous poor nations. The best way to predict what the media is going to look at is by looking at where the money is. So you notice that this map is actually mostly pale. The pale colors mean that you're seeing about the media attention that you would expect. And so essentially what we're saying is that finance is a pretty good fit for predicting media attention. There are, in fact, places where it's not a good fit. We don't pay a lot of attention to these booming South American economies. We don't pay a lot of attention to the Asian economies. We pay way too much attention to the Middle East, proportional to the money there. Obviously, some of this is proportional to the strife there. So this turns out to be a really old problem. You know, as much as I'm doing new research on it, the problem itself is tremendously old. In fact, in 1965, Galtung, Mary Rouge, an amazing pair of Norwegian thinkers, wrote a brilliant paper which essentially identified this problem. They sort of identified a set of overdog and underdog nations and went on to say that systemically they thought that underdog nations were undercovered. This ended up becoming a really interesting debate in the UN, which ended up being called NYCO, the New World Information Communication Order, where a number of emerging developing nations said, hey, satellite TV means that you should be able to get news from my country onto American television sets. Where the hell are we? And this turned into an enormous debate in UNESCO about whether developed world media should be required to pay more attention to developing world media. It was such a big debate that the US left UNESCO over the issue. We only rejoined in 2003 when the issue was really good and dead. So we've been talking about this for a very long time. So my temptation when I started drawing these maps was to beat up the media and to basically say, you bastards, why aren't you telling me about Africa? What's wrong with you guys? And while this is an easy thing to say, it turns out probably to be the wrong thing to say. I spend a lot of my time right now trying to figure out what web users want and what they want to know. We leave behind some really interesting information when we use certain tools on the web. These are results from Overture. This is how Overture lets you buy search engine terms. And you can see some really interesting things about what we think about Canada and what we think about Brazil. When we search for Canada, we seem to be searching for two things: cheap drugs and immigration. And depending on how things go in a month, I suspect that that search term could either go way up or way down. When we're looking at Brazil, we're also looking for two things. We seem to be looking for travel and naked people. So saving you the time, Mike in Brazil is a photographic site, perhaps not one that you want to load in this room with lots of other people watching you. This is the stuff of what I'm taking to calling internet sociology. This notion that we can actually make some really interesting sociological conclusions based on people's internet behavior and the traces that they leave behind. So here's a map of the world based on what we're searching for, according to Overture. This is what web users say that they want to know about. And it looks a whole lot like the maps we were looking at previously. The main corrections on these maps are that Brazil, India, and China are suddenly very popular. And that's because there's a huge growing internet population in those countries, Brazil especially. Africa, still largely not there. Central Asia, Eastern Europe, still not getting represented. We are a feedback loop for mainstream media. We tell mainstream media what we're interested in and what we're not interested in. And what we're telling mainstream media on the web right now is that we are not very interested in the developing world. So why does this matter? The great news is that Tom Barnett's already done my job here. If you look at the countries that Tom is worried about, they're also the countries that I'm worried about. They're failed and failing states. The one thing that I will add to what Tom said is that my research reveals that most of the failed and failing states that we have not yet invaded are countries that we pay very, very little attention to. And the way to think about why this is important, right after 9/11, there was suddenly a real interest in Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, because that's where the attacks came from. All sorts of al-Qaeda training networks going on in Central Asia. That interest lasted about 3 to 4 months, suddenly died down entirely. Do you really think those countries have changed all that much in that time? I don't. I think we basically just got bored. So I think it's broken. I think mainstream media coverage of international news is badly broken. And I think there's actually really good news, which is that I think we're actually in a position to try to fix it. And the reason that I believe this is that we're undergoing a paradigm shift in how media gets built, right? Prior to very recently, we had two kinds of media. We had state-controlled media and we had free market media. State-controlled media means that the state pays for reporting. And this actually tends to pull some biases out of the systems. If you look at the maps that I've done of the BBC covers the developing world much better than market media does. Because the government has decided, yeah, we're going to cover Africa. It's a priority for us. Now, BBC is the happy side of state-run media. Pravda is the bad side of state-run media. But it's good to know that you've got those polls. Market-driven media has this built-in bias. We tend to look at what the majority of people want to look at. And part of that is a broadcast phenomenon. To make money, you need to broadcast to a large number of people. If only a few people are interested in Africa, you're not going to hear about Africa. So the good news is that what's starting to enter the game is peer production. And peer production is very simple. Peer production just means we break down the barrier between the creator and the audience. There's no author and reader. We're all the same thing. You guys are seeing this left and right. It's open source software. It's blogging. It's Wikipedia. It's all of these places where people take responsibility for being part of the ecosystem that builds the media that they want to read. Now, the great thing about peer production is that people do it because it's fun. They write what they want to write. They talk about what they want to talk about. David is frantically blogging this talk, or probably checking his email, because he really enjoys going to conferences and blogging them. He does it because it's fun, not because someone's paying him to do it. The bad news about peer-produced media is that everybody writes what they want to write. And so what you get is a media that looks very much like the peer group. If you go onto Wikipedia right now, you're going to find out a whole lot more about Middle Earth and Tolkien than you are about Central Africa. So one of my hopes for where we go with this is by actively, consciously challenging how we build peer-produced media. A lot of the work that I'm doing right now is around the concept of bridge blogs. I'm really interested in people writing about parts of the world for a global audience. And the classic, the paradigmatic bridge blogger is Salim Pax, the Iraqi blogger who took it on himself to write in English for a global audience about what was going on in Iraq when we invaded. And he gave people an incredibly personal view of what was going on in his city, a perspective that you really couldn't get out of any other media. He's not alone. I help run a community called Blog Africa, which aggregates blogs from the entire African continent in 5 or 6 different languages. Blog Street India has recently launched a site looking at the 100 most popular Indian blogs. There's an amazing South Korean news site, which is also in English, called Oh My News, which is a daily newspaper jointly produced by individuals as well as by professional journalists. So ultimately, the idea that I want to leave you with, and I really do think in Alex Stephan's sense, this is a world-changing idea. This is a big problem. It is not as big as climate change. It is not as big as finding a way to sequester carbon dioxide. But the media is broken, and we need to fix it. And the good news is that there is something we can actively do about it. And that is to work to change the peer group. If you believe that peer-produced media is going to help us solve these problems, it is critical that that peer group is a global peer group. If we want to learn about Africa, we need to have Africans on the internet. It's as simple as that. So this brings us back to where I started, the digital divide. We need to bridge the digital divide, and the reason we need to bridge it is not just because Africans need the internet, it's because we need Africans on the internet. So I'm over my time. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a presentation from PopTech held in Camden, Maine, October 21st through 23rd, 2004. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.